Hello, this is Bob Dobbs again, and it's July 4th, 2014. We're doing part four in our conversation with Dennis Young. Dennis Young is the Professor Emeritus of Art History at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Now, we've been reviewing his article titled Painting and Its Paradigms, written by Dennis 12 years ago. If you want to follow along, you go to dennis-young.ca. That's dennis-young, Y-O-U-N-G.ca. Scroll down a bit and you'll see an article titled Painting and Its Paradigms. So there was one point Dennis wanted to correct in from part three. Do you want to say that now, Dennis?
Yes, hello.
Hello, Dennis.
Yes, I realized after we closed the session last time that when you asked me about British decadence, I was a bit ill-prepared for it, and the only name I came up with, and probably the only name I still would come up with, would be Aubrey Beardsley as a visual artist. But I confused him with a poet whose name was Swinburne, Algernon Swinburne, who wrote a great deal of poetry about sadistic or masochistic subjects. It came from the fact that Swinburne had been in one of those awful schools of the 19th century, or late 19th century, early 20th century, where flogging the boys was part of the schoolmaster's pleasures in life. Now and again, of course, it created people like Swinburne who actually found some kind of, crypto sexual response to being flogged. I've always believed that the people doing the flogging got a sexual experience out of it, and I think that's why it became so accepted by everybody. Anyway, I made that error, and I would just correct what I said and leave it at this man, Aubrey Beardsley, who died quite young. He died from tuberculosis. When he knew he was dying, he asked his executors to burn a great deal of his work. After his death, they decided that he would really like everybody to see what he'd been doing. So they did not burn his work. And we do have a considerable amount of work by Beardsley. I think he was embarrassed, and in some ways it raises a very interesting question of the philosophy of keeping to your promises. In any way, they didn't. I would like to add just a little bit to what we have already been saying. I was looking at the shelves in my library with Swedenborg and Blavatsky and so on. It might be of some interest for listeners to realize that it was not just Blavatsky or Uspensky, but a number of others that followed them and became influential in different countries. It's worth adding, I think, to them that after Blavatsky and Uspensky, who were pretty pompous and demanding and expecting to be respected for huge breakthrough in cosmology or whatever it is, you have Rudolf Steiner, who broke away from theosophy and invented anthroposophy. Theosophy would be knowledge of God. Anthroposophy would be knowledge of human existence.
Mm.
It's no surprise when one finds that Rudolf Steiner is the one person who has really survived very well. If you look at a graph of the number of schools, he was a school teacher, really, a very bright one, but he was a school teacher. And he persuaded someone who was a manufacturer of cigarettes, Waldorf Astoria Cigarettes, to support him. And he got a lot of support from this man. And so he called the schools Waldorf Schools.
Mm.
The number of Waldorf schools around today is larger than it's ever been.
Yes.
The graph goes up. What's the word of when graphs go up?
You mean asymptotically? That's the word, the one where it's approaching the edge. It's approaching infinity, never touches there. But that's a steep rise. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
The graph looks like that, asymptote. Yeah.
Yes. The whole theosophical business is not over. There are still theosophical societies in many countries, sometimes in several places in one country. At the time, there were also followers of Blavatsky who tried to simplify some of the ideas, especially the ideas that got taken up when theosophy arranged a sort of marriage with geometry, with n-dimensional geometry. You know, we find the names of some of the great mathematicians of the 19th century being consulted, partly because, although Blavatsky, as far as I know, never advised it, but because she did believe in a fourth dimension, which was the spiritual dimension. So although the mathematicians actually use not just a fourth dimension, but n numbers of dimensions, that is to say, they wanted to theorize a geometry with as many dimensions as you wanted to believe.
Mm.
I don't know enough about mathematics to say any more than that.
But your point was that the schools, the Steiner schools, spread vaster than the theosophical schools. Is that what
Yes.
you're saying?
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
I'm saying that theosophy is around, but it's pretty weak these days, I think.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there are a greater number of Steiner schools than there has ever been.
Yeah, I've heard people who do the schools, they want their kids to start schooling education early away from television and computers. So there's an argument whether that's useful or not, but it seems those that want to go with a sense of close to nature or close to pristine cognitive processes, they favor the Waldorf style. That's very careful to get the kids developing their own creativity or something, maybe you call it craft making, and not so involved on their tweeting and iPhones and video games so fast.
Yes, exactly so.
Yeah.
It appears that many of these schools, I don't know what the ratio is, but many of them are boarding schools in which the children are awakened by certain music.
Yeah.
Their lives are enhanced by colors, the colors of the classroom walls and so on, and by the garments they wear and so on. I'm not familiar very with the Waldorf schools, but I understand that that kind of thing is one matter that's attended to, that the environment is carefully studied and it's commensurate with Steiner's ideas about education. And you're right. I mean, it may be now dated in spite of the fact that the number of schools has increased. I don't know what to say about that. It's an interesting thought.
I think I heard that they are not that purist. They get the kids doing the pre-cybernetic world first, then they bring in the computers later. But they do it very, quote, ecologically. That's their sensitivity, you know. And that's I don't think they're like the Amish and reject technology. They're just very careful at the beginning of what gets the kids, what abilities they are bringing out of the kids.
You could say, and it would be interesting just to dwell on this for a second, you could say that he's a believer, I don't know whether this is really true, but you could say that he is a believer in the notion that children are born innocent and not, as the Christian church would have it, born with...
a stain.
I'm sorry, yes?
With a stain, original sin. They're born with
yes,
a stain.
With original sin. And this is commensurate with a lot of thought that began roughly with Rousseau and came down through Diderot and people like that, and even Voltaire, who laughed at it a bit, but nevertheless, in a sense, irrationally laughing at it, he supported it and spread the news about it. The notion of, that we now call primitivism, which is to say that the early members of the human race existed before the fall and were innocent and did not need a lot of the Christian church's education, so to speak. And that, of course, brings you back to the symbolists, who certainly believed that in many ways, anyway.
They were Rousseau?
Well, I'm not sure that I could tell you which symbolist had read Rousseau, but most of those young... Well, we took about a dozen people to discuss, and they were the people who you could faultlessly call symbolists. What they showed in their art was often the style of drawing of a child.
Hmm.
This Bonnard, I think I may have mentioned this.
You did mention the Bonnard, the childish skill.
Yes. That notion of primitivism, which is hugely important in lots of ways, it was just worth mentioning, I think.
McLuhan said that Baudelaire was the second school of Romanticism, where he didn't run out to the moors and the landscapes to find original nature. He found nature in the cities. He saw the new shop windows and the technology around them as a new kind of nature. So they aren't Luddites, or at least he isn't. Is he thinking of this, childhood innocence, or is he not of that school, and he's looking at technology is inevitable, and he's trying to write a new kind of poetry to respond to the city landscapes?
Oh, it's very difficult to say, isn't it?
Right. Baudelaire, is he influenced by Rousseau or not?
I would say no, he isn't. As you said, he exchanged romping around in the fields and so on, which is normally how we see innocent children. He romped around in the darker shadows of the big city.
Yeah, and that was new.
And that was decadent in a way, I think.
Yes, that's what McLuhan said. He was the second romantic movement. The symbolists were romantics, but on a different milieu, different environmental preference. Or at least Baudelaire was, and he was pretty influential.
Yes, he was, and I think that's a way to look at him.
Is the Montessori school like the Waldorf schools?
No, I don't think so. Montessori created her own schools. I'm not so sure whether it was even in the plural. She certainly wrote books suggesting that people followed her examples. For instance, she provided toys for the children. I mean, she took... Montessori, I think, was mainly concerned with young children under 12 or under 10 years or something. Mm. Maybe even infant schools. That's how I see Montessori anyway.
The thing is she working with the blank slate idea?
Yes, that is something that exists after Locke. There was as early as the 5th century a Christian monk, Pelagius, who claimed that children were born innocent. And this is the heresy that has always lingered somewhere in the vicinity of the Christian church, rejected by the church itself, but taken up by other thinkers. You can easily say, I think, that it lies behind the famous statement by Locke, the philosopher, around 1680, when he said, the mind is a blank sheet, or we're born with nothing, and we're formed by our environment, by what we take in onto that blank sheet.
Mm.
That was his view. I don't know how contentious it is now, because the entire church is in question about evil and all the rest of it these days. When you know about the unconscious and the structure of the unconscious, and when you have access to the mind through the various methods of viewing the brain and so on. I mean, we know, for instance, now that psychopathic individuals have all got part of their brain missing.
Mm.
And the man who discovered or worked on this recently published a book saying that he'd taken his own photo, the photo of his own brain, or had it done, and he came out with a psychopathic brain. He wrote a very interesting book trying to decide just what it was besides this kind of brain to create someone who was a psychopath. We're off a long way off the track, but
this is we're talking about the retrieval of Pelagius by the Theosophists and Montessori, and especially Steiner, And
yes.
just that is a influence that was involved with the art world at the end of the 19th century. That's why we're talking about that. Now, we were going to discuss Walter Pater's statement about art aspiring to the condition of music and bringing some synesthesia. In your essay, you have a section called Silent Music, and then it's followed with abstract language. We're going to put that off because that's a more generally recognized part of the early 20th century history, late 19th century. And you told me a few weeks ago that you had a different approach to this, where you can look at the history of, say, the last 120 years of art in the West, where some painters aligned with architects and other painters aligned with poets. Sounded very interesting, sounded original. So let's hear this view of entering the 20th century before we get to the Dadaists and the Surrealists and the turmoil of the World War I, I guess we call it. What happened? How do you get to this theory, Dennis?
It's not so much a theory, it's in full evidence. But perhaps I'm taking a leap that some scholars wouldn't take.
That's okay.
But when you consider the futurists, the Dadaists, and the Surrealists, they never made works which were abstract or non-figurative works. Furthermore, in each of them, there was always one, two, and sometimes many poets. And sometimes the poets actually became, in their own way, visual artists as well. So on the one hand, you can argue that a lot of artists allied with poets created an art which was still figurative, even if the figuration was not what you might call realistic. On the other hand, at the very time this was beginning, just before the First World War, there were individuals taking up on our old friend Madame Blavatsky and Theosophy. In each case, in the case of the Dutch, the Russians, the Germans, and the French, again, you don't hear us saying very much about the British, but in those countries, there was some connection with Theosophy and a great connection with what had been happening for the previous 100 years in the development of the machine. So I'd like to begin talking about this matter by pointing out some of the circumstances as they developed during the 19th century, which led to the situation of suprematism, Bauhaus, and Le Corbusier, and the style people in Holland. If we think about the 19th or even the 18th century, some of it is there. For instance, in the 1770s, we have the first factories, the first power looms, the first engines that develop production. And that means the shift to the cities from the countryside by thousands of people in Europe, and the creation of slums and disease, while at the same time, the chemists and the engineers are going ahead with new materials and building the first iron bridge, which was built in 1775 in Coalbrookdale in England. And even in the Louvre, where an iron roof was constructed for the Grand Salon, there were, in response to this situation of poverty and slums and disease, socialist revolutions all over Europe, leading to Marx and the Communist Manifesto and to his famous book, Capital. There was the quarrel over Darwin's Origin of Species, the notion of survival of the fittest, which got corrupted and led to something called social Darwinism, so that there was a theory that justified the slums and disease as part of the human lot. In short, people who were poor not because there was no work or because they were being exploited, but poor because they were the weak ones in Darwin's sense of the origin of species, which was a corruption of Darwin, of course.
That was Herbert Spencer. He created social Darwinism, right?
When I was a schoolboy, he was the first philosopher I read, and I could never understand what he was getting at.
And that was assigned in school, or you just found him on your own?
No, I just found him on my own. And, you know, it's not a good idea to get into philosophy on your own, is it?
Nope.
By the time we get to the 60s and the 70s, we also have talked a little bit about the unification of Italy, the unification of Germany, and the sort of background arguments that supported them, even though really it was political. In the case, for instance, of the unification of Germany, the word Realpolitik became used. This was Bismarck's invention.
Yes.
And it meant put your conscience in a bag and forget about it. Get on with creating what you want to do if you have to march over everybody else. And Nietzsche, of course, was a German philosopher who philosophized about the Superman, who could do that and do it without suffering from conscience.
Yeah, the bourgeois conscience, Nietzsche thought, was very belittling. Shouldn't
so
have that.
So there's turmoil all through the 19th century.
Now, is Spencer influencing Nietzsche, or this different attitude just pops up all over the place independently of Spencer?
My sense of it is that Nietzsche, is, at the time and since, has been seen as the most original thinker, someone who threw aside much of the, what's the phrase I should use?
Platitudes, the common sense of the middle-class life.
Yes, but more than that, I mean, much of his writing was on morals.
Yes.
And so he wrote about a certain aspect of moral behavior and created a sense of living, and in a way, it was almost Darwinistic in the sense that the people that he praised were the people who were going to survive. They were going to be the fittest. So they fitted in with social Darwinism even.
You were talking about how this influences the architectural dominance or the interest in architecture because now you have nations and cities being built. Is that what you're saying? Or industrial cities?
You have industry. In a way, what Nietzsche stood for was taken up at the end of the 19th century in several countries in Europe by the youth of Europe. Whether they were quite as lacking in moral scruples as his Superman, who was called Zarathustra, of course, I'm not sure. But in France, there was the movement called the Young People of Today. In Germany, there was the Fond de Vogel. There were even the Boy Scouts begun in Britain. Everywhere you looked, the youth somehow had been better educated, and also they'd seen enough of the freedoms that could happen under certain political circumstances and under certain circumstances that you have to call existential. This was Nietzsche, of course, again. They probably all heard in some way or other of that. What is interesting is that it leads to the First World War. You have a middle-class, well-educated public of younger people who see themselves as being weakened. And this is the decadent thing again. Who see themselves as being weakened by the poverty of the life they live, which is too much concerned with eating well and drinking well and having a good time and being, in fact, physically feeble, made feeble. They wanted to be much more like Zarathustra.
So this is a reaction in the 1900s and 1910s against the decadence of the 1890s.
That's right. And it turns in Italy into futurism. So we have a little justification for mentioning these matters. The other thing that I think is worth mentioning, although it is a non sequitur in a way, is the development of anarchism in various countries, particularly from Russia, but not only in Russia, and the attempt to spark some kind of incredible change in society, which as an anarchic society would not require a government and not require the leaders with all the money and so on. So from 1880 onwards until right through into the 1930s, we have a very large number of significant individuals in every country who either suffered attempted assassinations or actually were assassinated. The king of Russia, the president of the USA, the king of Spain, the king of Portugal, the president of France, the king of Austria, and of course the fellow in Serbia who was finally assassinated, which actually brought about the First World War, was said to have done or said to have contributed to it. Such were the situations of the countries of that time.
Yeah, the anarchist was seen as we talk about the terrorists today. They were a major figure in the news of that period.
Yes, it's an interesting discussion about how much they were terrorists and how much they were not. I think the argument generally goes that terrorists don't choose their specific person to assassinate, whereas the anarchists, on the whole, did. I mean, it's no accident that all the leaders of Russia, USA, Spain, Portugal, France, Austria, and Serbia were actually assassinated. And then, of course, they would, in France, for instance, there were several occasions of throwing a hand grenade from the observation gallery in Parliament and so on.
Mm.
It became an extraordinary infestation in a way.
And you're saying the anarchists had an ideology?
Yes.
Yeah.
They thought that the whole of the working population would rise up against their masters if what they did electrified them enough. They called it the spark.
Right.
They were supposed to create the spark that would explode across an entire continent, you know. And for a moment, in 1848, at the time when Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto, it seemed to be doing that.
Yes.
Trouble was that it didn't last very long, 2 or 3 years in this or that country, and next thing you knew was you were back to where you were before it all began.
Right, and then it would burst up again with the Paris Commune around 1870.
Well, that's right. Yes, again. Absolutely.
And then there's the Haymarket something in the 80s, I think, 1880s in the States. But is there something after the Paris Commune that the radicals cite? Maybe Rosa Luxemburg and what she had going just before World War One. I'm not sure. I'm just wondering if there was anything after the famous Paris Commune.
Oh, yes. It hardly started. These anarchist assassinations had hardly started.
No, but I'm thinking of a spark. Remember, the Paris Commune got the imagination of the people. At least that's how it's presented to us. And just like 1848 and 1850s with Marx, what is there anything in the 1890s or 19... Well, the futurists, maybe, right? I'm talking about a populist spark.
Let me go off at another little tangent. That is that in Paris, among the visual artists, about, let's be careful not to overstate, but 50% of all the visual artists in Paris were signed-up anarchists.
This is like from 1870 on, after the Paris Commune?
Something like that, because what's amusing about the creation of the Salon des Indépendants in 1884, it was Signac, the friend of Seurat and one of the post-impressionists, who was well-known, of course, at that time. He sort of led the movement that created this annual salon, where people could bring their works and there would be no judgment of it. If they paid them money, they could hang their work.
Mm.
And that was an anarchist attitude, and he was an inscribed anarchist. But what was amusing, and what is amusing when you think about it, is that even though he was anarchist, he stayed as the fellow who ran the whole thing for 30 years. I mean, he was the high priest of an institution which shouldn't have had a high priest at all.
This is Signet, S-I-G-N-A-C.
That's right, S-I-G-N-A-C.
Is he a pointillist?
Yes, he was a pointillist.
Okay.
Yes.
So that helped pointillism get prominence, right? Because he was in charge of the Salon.
Yes. Well, as I said, the Salon des Indépendants was invented to counter the problem of the big salon that half of them couldn't get into ever, you know.
Right, right. And we covered that in,
yes,
I think, in part three.
Yes.
Okay, so we're moving towards the idea that the artists, some of them aligned with the architects.
Yes, so we want to ask what kind of aesthetic comes with architecture. And I think to do that, we'll just run through some of the things that had happened in the later 19th century. For instance, steel made the possibility of buildings up to about 8 stories. Steel with concrete, of course. Concrete was around, but it didn't get used, I think, in the first instances.
Mm.
In any case, an 8-story building would have been something if you lived at the top floor. You'd have to walk up all the time. There was the first mass production of furniture. Mass production took off about in the 1840s. There was also, of course, the so-called Great Exhibition of 1851 in England, where everything that the English had done was on show. Stupid things, but also extraordinary things.
That was called the Crystal Palace?
Yes, it was the Crystal Palace. It's an interesting little story, the creation of the Crystal Palace, which is worth telling, I think, in this context.
Okay.
The guy who finally won the prize to design the so-called Crystal Palace, it was called Crystal Palace because, in fact, it was made of glass. And he was a well-known designer of greenhouses, which seems an unlikely kind of commission for him to get. It was the Prince Consort, of course, Victoria's husband, who was running this, and he must have had a lot of good sense.
Is that Albert?
Yes, that's Albert. Yeah. What is so interesting about the Crystal Palace is that it was absolutely huge. I can't give you the dimensions, but it was like a huge, cleverly built greenhouse that didn't look boring at all. It had a sort of big central doorway thing, and it looked very attractive as a building. But it was built so large that it was built over all the trees in Hyde Park that were in the way. They never cut the trees down. They just built the thing high enough to go over the top of the trees. And the way they did it, and the way in which Paxton had been building greenhouses, was to use the modular method. Now, the modular method is something that is still very much being used in architecture today, but it began in 19th century greenhouses and became famous when Paxton used the idea of modules. Now, modules means that you have one standard measure, and you repeat and repeat and repeat. For instance, in a huge glass house, you would be repeating the size of the window panes, and just sort of order 3,000 of bits of iron with some kind of groove to take a glass, whatever, with all the necessary nuts and bolts and so on, so that you could go on building it higher and higher and longer and so on. And obviously with some knowledge of the stresses that you had to cope with. But it's amazing to know that it went over the top of huge oak trees that had been there for hundreds of years.
Now, is Paxton, he wins the contract to build the palace? Is that what you're saying?
He won the contract to design it.
Actually
built it.
Right. Not that there was an exhibition and he won a prize within the exhibition. He won the prize to start it, to create the environment for the exhibition.
That's right, he did. And he must have known where he could get his iron casted for the building of the thing. And I may add that when this great exhibition, which impressed the European countries no end, of course, when that exhibition was over, all the European countries said, well, we better have one too. And also, the Germans particularly sent people over to Britain to find out what the hell was going on there because they didn't want to be left behind.
Mm.
And the sort of things that they saw, the engines and one thing and another that they saw, the armaments, everything there that was manufactured in Britain was in the show.
Are you saying that this is the beginning of an influence on painters, or the beginning?
Yes, I'm saying that it was going to be a great influence on architects, and that its success in architecture influenced the way in which painters started to make non-representational art.
Well, the guy who made cleared the boulevards of Paris, isn't that in the 1850s? Is he influenced by the Crystal Palace?
No.
Okay.
I mean, he comes after the Crystal Palace. He comes in the 1860s. But what he did was he demolished huge areas of slum dwellings in the center of Paris, and he created some of the great boulevards, big, wide, open streets with plenty of air. Of course, even today you have people who criticize the whole of that effort because they say he was really in the employ of Napoleon III, and Napoleon III wanted streets where you could move an army from one end of town to the other if there was trouble.
Yes, yeah.
However, I don't look at it that way, because he also built the huge sewerage system in Paris, which still exists. That was, of course, a colossal advantage in France, to have sewerage that actually worked. It cut down all kinds of diseases, abolished a lot of diseases and so on.
And that was Mr. Haussmann we're talking about.
That's right.
Now, if the Crystal Palace was built over the trees, it didn't lead to slum clearance, right? Since it was built over the park.
No, it was done in Hyde Park, one of the big parks in London. What was interesting was when the show was over and everything was removed, because it was made in this modular way, they took it all down and moved it about 20 miles away from the center of town and built it up again.
Did they clear any slums there?
No, I think they found more grass or whatever.
Right.
Perhaps more trees, you know.
I know the Crystal Palace burnt down, I think, in the 30s.
Yes, it did.
1930s.
And it's never been rebuilt.
There's one interesting side story. It turned out that there was secret research into television in the whatever was left over the Crystal Palace in the 30s. And there's a question of why it was burnt down. Some thought the Nazis burned it down because they didn't want that kind of research happening, getting ahead of them on the TV level. So I don't know if you ever heard of that, but that's an interesting point of the cause of the fire.
Uh-huh. No, I didn't know.
So slum clearance, is Haussmann the first slum clearance guy?
I think so.
Right.
I think
okay.
So, yeah. What the ultimate motive was isn't clear to me. It's, as I say, it's disputed by people. Let's just say that if it was correct that the boulevards were really built to move troops around the city to put down rebellions, then it actually did work at the event of
The Paris Commune in 1870.
The Paris Commune of 1870, yeah.
Right, right. It did work. So he had built them in the 1860s, and that prepared for what they felt, the elite felt. Something was going to rise up with the emotion of multitude, and it happened in 1870, and they stopped it pretty easily.
Yes, the problem, of course, in 1870 was that there had been a war with Germany, and it hadn't gone at all well for Napoleon III. He'd had to run.
Right.
And when he ran out and the army disintegrated, the commune in Paris decided that this was an opportunity to do something, which, of course, was pretty ridiculous. I mean, okay, in 1789, when they'd done it, it worked. But, you know, it worked for reasons that was beyond their comprehension then. And it failed because it was beyond their comprehension in 1870. Sure.
Right. It's a more complex technological society, what McLuhan would call an invisible environment.
Yeah.
People didn't realize the implications of that.
Absolutely.
So who were some of the first painters who started aligning with the architects in this last quarter of the 19th century?
Well, I mean, we're agreeing that the Eiffel Tower, when that was put up, was supposed to be the Paris equivalent in 1889 of what had gone on in 1851 in Britain,
right,
with the Crystal Palace.
And it worked. It was a big phenomenon, the Eiffel Tower.
Yes, and they had a great Halle des Machines in Paris, too. So that by the end of the century, a lot of things had changed, and the speed of change was extraordinary. We had bicycles by then. Mm. We had steel ships. We had motorized ships. We had incandescent light bulbs, electric motors. Electric trams were running before cars were sort of running in,
yeah,
the streets. You had trams running in the streets. You had elevators now that permitted much higher buildings than 8 stories. You had department stores. You even had mail order stores from 1897 in North America. And then you had advertisement designs, and this brings in, to some extent, the visual artists, of course.
Someone pointed out once that the bicycles was an impetus for the suffragette movement. Women, for the first time, could get out of their domestic limitations and get out in the country and have a little freedom with the bicycle.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. And, of course, I suppose it's not until the 20s that you see posters of women on bicycles, but you do see it... that by the 1920s, even though in Britain anyway, they didn't have the vote until 1928, nevertheless, you did see them happily cycling away.
Yeah. So, okay, so are you going to name any particular artists that are influenced by all this building going on around them?
What I'd like to turn to is that there was an idea of function. You asked yourself, what's the function of this building? How can we deal with the function using steel and ferroconcrete and glass and so on? And the idea of a total artwork, what the Germans called Gesamtkunstwerk.
Now, does that come in with Wagner? Is he the originator of that idea?
Yes, he's the originator of it in the theater, isn't he? Absolutely. But it spread to a sort of a total scenario for building as well.
Okay.
The idea became, in a sense, to transform the human habitat. I think that's how you would put it. There was a sort of rationalism going on. From about the beginning of the Second World War, or even a bit before, the Germans had come up with the idea of a machine style, and that you would create architecture schools so that somewhere around the first decade, they sent a man called Hermann Mutisius to England, and he was there for 10 years trying to assess how the English built their houses. And he came back and wrote a book that became very famous in 1907 in Germany called The English House, Das Englische Haus,
mm-hmm,
praising the English for their bathrooms and so on. God knows what they'd got in Germany if they were praising, mm-hmm, English bathrooms, but they were. They had an idea that they called, I'm not sure how you pronounce the German, Sachlichkeit. It means something like a simple utility. That's what they began to preach, the idea of something that was simple and that worked. And
functional. So, you're talking about function.
Yes, function. And functionalism, you know, became a word that was commonly used.
In Germany.
In Germany, and it spread.
Do you have a critic or name other than this book, 1907, that's identified with it?
Yes, the most important person in Germany was a man called Behrens, B-E-H-R-E-N-S. He became the first ever artist to be consulted by an industrial plant. They came to him and they basically said, look, we want you to design a place where we create big engines, electrical engines. He basically used, in parts of it anyway, he used a lot of glass and a lot of metal.
But he was a painter, not an architect.
No, he was an architect. And he ran a big architectural firm where four or five of the most important artists of the first half of the 20th century were his assistants. Their names were Walter Gropius,
yeah,
Adolf Meyer, who later became Gropius's partner in business, a man called Mies van der Rohe, and the French architect who later changed his name to Le Corbusier.
So these famous architects, Gropius, Mies van der Rohe, Corbusier, and what was the other guy, Myers?
Adolf Meyer.
Yeah, they're all famous. They all come out of this guy's firm.
Yes, they did.
Wow.
And it was because, you know, he was introducing these new ideas about how to build things that were simple utility, this Schachtlichkeit idea.
Right, but these Gropius and them are not painters. They're architects, no, right, in training.
Absolutely.
So where now, does the painter start aligning with the architects?
The guy who called himself Le Corbusier had been a painter.
Mm.
When he set up his own business, he left the painting behind, but he did come up with all kinds of new ideas about how to build. In effect, Corbusier himself, who had been a painter, he is the sort of lone individual who takes up architecture. And he writes about it. There had been a war, and in 1917, Corbusier wrote a sort of article that he called the Rappel à l'Ordre, Recall to Order. In fact, he was really comparing the idea of an ordered civil society after the war with the way in which you would design housing, or, in his case, mostly housing.
Town planning.
Town planning, if you like, yes.
Yeah.
He had lots of interesting theories. Among them, well, that geometry would be involved. For instance, as he developed his way of approach, he invented a modular system like had been used for the Crystal Palace, in the sense that it was modular. He also created that strange, unmeasurable ratio, which we call the Fibonacci series, mm-hmm, or and he used that because that reminded him and reminded everyone who knew about it as a measure of living things.
Yes.
The Fibonacci system of numbers, as you know, it can be found in the way a tree grows, the way in which the branches get smaller as the tree gets higher and so on.
It's an update of the golden section.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So are you saying that the architect becomes a figure in the public mind of creativity in the 20s and usurps the painters? The Picassos and that, or what's the point here? Because where do the artists start coming into this?
They start coming into it much more in Germany, in Russia, and in Holland.
Right, so you've got the Stiel in Holland. Who do you have in Germany, the Expressionists or the Blue Rider?
Well, I'm not sure that Peter Behrens was the person who organized the school at Weimar, but at Weimar, there was a school, and before the war, it had aimed at some of the things that we'd just been mentioning.
Yeah.
And when the war came, this student of Behrens, Gropius, became the president-elect of the school. That was at Weimar. And after the war in 1919, and in spite of the most extraordinary deprivation that went on in Germany after that war, they were able to build a school which they called the Bauhaus. Now, the Bauhaus, if you translate it, it's a strange idea. It's the house for houses. Bau and house are almost identical.
The house, yeah.
So it's the place where houses are considered and reorganized and so on, building is done.
Yeah, today they would say it's housing goes meta, is how they would say it today. It's thinking about housing, and it's a house that does that, right?
Yes.
So are there artists coming to the Bauhaus school?
Well, this was the whole idea of the Bauhaus. It was to say that architecture and the visual arts in general, even some of the crafts, have a lot in common. And we want to integrate all of these aspects of visual art. And whatever happens to the students who come here, whether they become painters or whether they become architects or, you know, the designers of instruments or the designers of God knows what, they need an initiation course. So the Bauhaus formed a course which is still given in lots of art schools across the Western world, where you begin with a sort of general course that introduces you to all kinds of materials and what you might do with them, and opens up students who thought it was all to do with sharpening a pencil and drawing on paper.
So you're saying this is the first interdisciplinary institute?
Absolutely. The Bauhaus was, yes.
Right. Right. That's interesting. One thing, you mentioned nothing going on in Britain. You have in 1919 Wyndham Lewis writing the book The Caliph's Design, and subtitled Architects, Where's Your Vortex? Lewis seems to be, I don't know any of his colleagues were, he was tuning into this new trend of architecture.
Amazingly, he was, yeah. As you know, I'm not very familiar with him.
Did you know of that book that he wrote in 1919?
No, I don't know it.
Yeah, Caliph's Design, subtitled Architects, Where Is Your Vortex?
You see, I think the reason why he's less known than, say, Gropius, is that he never really produced architecture himself, as far as I know.
That's right. You know, he did criticize Picasso and the French Cubist movement. He said, you guys are still working in the studios. We need to get out there and be city planners, town designers. Now, he'd been in Germany before World War I. He may have picked up on a lot of this stuff. He was the most traveled artist of London before World War One.
Yes, yes. And he was wealthy, too.
Well, yeah, he had his mother's money funding him, moving around so he could be... He lived everywhere, all over the place. So he had the advantage of picking up on the Kandinsky and the Expressionists. There's even new essays about he influenced with Blast, it came out in 1914, he influenced the Constructivists in Russia. So he was sitting there being interdisciplinary himself and advocating it. But it happens in the Bauhaus. They pull it off, is the point here.
Yes, they pulled it off, and they employed people with some reputation as artists, people like Kandinsky, to come and teach there. One of the interesting things is that they didn't mind the fact that Kandinsky was really a theosophist. And goodness knows, you know, how they managed to cope with that if he was really adamant.
Yeah.
But anyway, Kandinsky came, and he wrote his book called Concerning the Spiritual in Art. Now, that's a theosophical thing, if ever you can find one. And it was published in 1922. I should have made a sort of list of people who were also teaching as artists in the Bauhaus. I didn't make such a list, and we'll have to pass on and look at De Stijl.
Which is spelled D-E-S-T-I-H-L?
No, it's S-T-I-J-L.
That's right, J-L.
The Dutch are very perverse, and it's a difficult language to speak.
Right. So they're happening, and also, where does the Blue Rider, where's that? Is that in Germany, the Blue Rider group?
Yes, that was in Germany, but it was really something to do with what we regard as the Expressionist painters.
So that's so, not part of what you're talking about. You're saying Steele is more with the architects.
That's right. It's not really what we're talking about.
All right. Okay.
And it's pre-war, too. Pre-World War One, of course.
And Mondrian is part of that, right?
Not in the Blue Rider, no.
No, the Steele.
He's part of De Steele.
Yes.
Mondrian became a theosophist. He had his own theosophical teacher whose name was Schoenmakers. And I think Schoenmakers means shoemaker. So his name was M.J.H. Shoemaker in translation, I think. He wrote a book called The New Image of the World. So he's very much like the people that we've already mentioned, Uspensky and
Steiner.
Like
yeah.
Yes.
Steiner. Here's an idea. So the idea of a theosophist, a bit scandal having him in the Bauhaus, is like in the last 15, 20 years of Scientology, right? It's similar to, this guy's a Scientologist today, that's suspect. Back then, to be a theosophist was pretty notorious, like Scientology is today. Would you make those parallels?
No, I think that's a bit unfair, because I think, for instance, Blavatsky did write a little book, which basically is a summary of the way theosophists should behave.
Yeah.
I don't think she wanted to change anyone's psyche. That's the point. I think she wanted to make life for people more spiritual, whatever that might mean. But I mean, I don't understand what Scientology is trying to do to anybody. I don't think it's the same.
Right. Okay, so it's not the same image, but it still was controversial to be a theosophist.
I don't think people bragged about being a theosophist. I think it was something they did on the quiet, in a way.
Okay. You're saying that people back then, they didn't really know Kandinsky was a theosophist. It's only art history that brings that out.
When Kandinsky writes a book called Concerning the Spiritual in Art, he's trying to do something that is a bit like Steiner. I mean, there was a little group of people who we've not really talked about in the theosophical sphere. Well, we mentioned Annie Besant last week as being her right-hand helper and a leading socialist in Britain. She and a guy called C.W. Leadbeater wrote a book called Thought Forms. And this was to do with how to see auras around a person and by the kind of aura that you saw to judge their personality or their state of mind. It's a book which I'd have to confess I find ludicrous. For instance, there are two parts of it. One is to show you the aura around people who are in certain moods. Depressed moods look like you'd see a black cloud over their head or something. And anger moods would show lightning things flashing from the back of their skull or something. It's that crude and silly in my view. But they did do that. And I think Kandinsky, in his way, had something of the same idea. He also was interested in, especially just before the First World War, and before he got involved with the Bauhaus when he lived in Munich, he was interested, too, in the apocalypse, that part of the Bible of St. John the Divine, where he describes the end of the world.
Yeah, the Book of Revelation.
And I think I mentioned he made a series of woodcuts and published them in a sort of book form.
You're talking about Kandinsky.
Yes, I'm talking about Kandinsky. I'm looking at two pages from this book on my wall here. And we're talking about 1910, and you cannot tell what's at stake visually in most of these images. But you can just see, if you take a lot of time looking, that they are probably to do with this apocalyptic moment. Because you can see, for instance, something like a house on a hill that's crumbling. you can see something like the Four Horses of the Apocalypse. But my goodness, you'd never know unless you knew what to look for.
Right.
But if you know you can look for four horses, yes, you can see four horses. If you look for the bodies of people emerging from graves, you can see a shrouded figure emerging from a rock. You wouldn't even know it was a figure. But if you know about the apocalypse, you can identify this. He had made them so they were extremely unbodied. That's a good word, right, for you, unbodied.
Discarnate.
Yes, and that was part of his attitude and thought.
Right.
No doubt he brought to the Bauhaus, too, when he wrote a book called Concerning the Spiritual in Art.
A big figure of the icon of theosophy was Jiddu Krishnamurti. Are you aware of him? Like in the 20s, he was promoted as the world savior, as the second coming. Have you ever heard of him?
Well, I've heard of Krishnamurti, and my friend Eileen Boyd used to know him in the 1950s.
That's the mother of the guitarist, right? Irene Boyd, or is that the daughter?
Yes, that's the mother.
The mother of, what's her name?
Leona Boyd.
Leona Boyd, yes.
Yeah.
So Krishnamurti was a big deal in the 20s. I wonder if he influenced artists or...
I don't think so. I don't know enough about him to know whether he did or not. But to me, he was the leader of a sort of religious faction from India.
Yes, he was the Ledbetter prodigy. Ledbetter and Annie Besant were the faction that raised Krishnamurti up.
Oh, well then, in that case, that's case proven, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, he might well have been much closer than I've ever thought to being a theosophist. Yeah.
Well, he came out of the theosophy and the Besant-Ledbetter faction. There are, in old books, newspaper articles on him, all through the 20s when he's speaking or showing up. And then when he resigned, quit the Theosophical Movement in 1929, I think, that was a big deal. That upset a lot of the Theosophical influence. He went on his own.
Still haven't completed talking about the style and suprematism and so on.
Oh, well, let's do a little bit more on that.
Let's see if I can... put a few ideas,
yeah.
Put out a few ideas about them. We'll talk about the Dutch movement called the style, that's what it really means. Here is the style, and it's based in theosophy as far as Mondrian is concerned, for sure, because of this man Shoemakers, who was his guide, you know. Anyway, let me put it this way, that Mondrian, early on, before the First World War, well before the First World War, is both a theosophist and he's interested in Paris and the Cubists. His realistic drawings gradually become less and less realistic and more geometric, so to speak. That's an oversimplification, but it will have to do for the time being. He meets up during the war, because during the war, Holland was not involved. But the Dutch couldn't get out of the country and back again. They couldn't go visiting Paris or something. So there was this little group of people very interested in the new art forms that were coming, who simply got together and made a sort of society that in 1917, before the war was over, they called the style. And their object was to create a style for architecture, well, and painting too, because Mondrian was a painter, not an architect. And Van Doesburg, who was the guy who delivered the funds for the creation of this little group, and who started to publish the magazine that they called De Style. It lasted from 1917 to 1931. So that's, 14 years. That's not bad going. And it discussed, of course, in its pages, not so much the theosophical matters, but nevertheless, it did discuss the kind of architecture that would have suited Mondrian's view as a theosophist, and that's very interesting. It's very interesting to get a book of Mondrian's work and begin at the beginning and turn the pages over. And you can see how, little by little, as each year goes by, the realism of the subject is increasingly lost until somewhere around 1917, you see drawings that have simply little horizontal lines or little plus signs. It's like plus and minus signs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You'll find that the title is Viewing the Sea from the Beach of the Sea. You know, the Holland, of course, looks out into the North Sea or whatever. And from that use of vertical and horizontal lines and dashes, which has sort of been put into his head by shoemakers, that's the interesting thing. It's very difficult to understand what Mondrian meant by the sense that the universe was contained by vertical and horizontal and nothing else. But that seems to have been what he believed. In the simplifying of everything, you had then vertical lines and horizontal lines, and you had the three primary colors of paint, yellow, red, and blue, and black lines. So apart from black lines in red, yellow, and blue, you won't find anything after about 1920 that Mondrian did that has more than that.
Mm.
Sometimes he loses a couple of the colors and all you see is black lines plus one little square of blue somewhere. But his friends who belonged to the movement began to build houses, domestic houses, that really looked like three-dimensional versions of Mondrian's paintings.
Mm.
And the main person that did that, his name was Rietveld. And in Amsterdam now, there is still an academy with the name of Rietveld in it. I'm not sure whether he had anything to do with its inauguration. But out of respect for his extraordinary houses, which looked, I mean, I've seen one of them, the Schroeder House. There are not many around. But they looked extraordinarily what one might call modern. They were, it seems, modular. There was color in them, especially inside. You know, you'd have a red wall, a blue wall, or whatever. In short, they looked like a three-dimensional Mondrian painting. And Van Doesburg, the man with the money who was publishing the journal, he became involved as an architect and was drawn to Mondrian's ideas. At about the time the journal ended in 1931, I'm not sure of his dates, but he had the audacity to offend Mondrian by putting in something that was neither horizontal nor perpendicular, but was at an angle. So Mondrian sort of quit. That was heresy for him to have something that was neither perpendicular nor horizontal.
Now, this is not earlier than 1917 when the journal's happening. This is happening basically after World War One. This movement.
Yes, that's right. It's in the 20s and 30s. And in the period just before the war, or maybe just after the Second War started, Mondrian moved to Paris, and then he realized that Germans were going to occupy Paris. So he moved to New York,
right,
where he died three years later. But when he got to New York, what was interesting was that for the first time, these lines became not black lines, but colored lines. And then they broke up into little blobs or bits of color. The lines were broken into, it's like a piece of ticker tape, if you know what I mean.
Right. So he loosened up. Isn't it a story that jazz affected him or something?
Yes, it is. He heard jazz pianists for the first time, Boogie Woogie, in fact.
Yeah.
And when you look at these, he named one of them Boogie Woogie.
Right.
I'm not sure whether he said New York Boogie Woogie, but he named them Boogie Woogie. And it's rather interesting to see those works, because you can certainly see how boogie-woogie pianist might, in fact, enjoy having one in front of him as he played, you know. It was really very odd. And he had lots of records of them, to the point that, though I can't tell you without going to my records, my old discs, I bought some of them too. So maybe
back then, or as a collector?
No, as someone who just could go out to a record store and say, I want to see your records by this or that.
Yeah.
Boogie-woogie player. There's so much to say about De Stael and Mondrian, however, that, you know, I'll leave it at that.
Bauhaus is the name, the icon. You know, Tom Wolfe's book, From Bauhaus to Our House or something. But De Stael,
right.
Are you saying De Stael is as influential as Bauhaus, or significant, or as important?
Oh, yes, I am, because you might say of the two, and this is the kind of critique that we've had by some of the theorists, scholars, and in fact, in that website of mine, I review a book by a critic and author of architectural materials whose name is Rainer Banham. The book's title is Theory and Design in the First Machine Age.
Mm. Does he emphasize De Stael over Bauhaus or something like that? That's what we were talking about, comparing the influence of De Stael and the Bauhaus.
I think that he doesn't say too much about De Stael. He does about the Bauhaus, and he's very critical, because what he claims is, and I think it's a fair claim, one of the precepts of the Bauhaus was functionalism. In fact, you know, we've already concluded that. The point being, if you designed a house, it should be a house where everything was very convenient. They called it functionalism. And they said of their houses, so to speak, of their buildings, of their designs, that it was a functionalist building. And in fact, Rainer Banham revealed that really none of them obeyed the sort of discipline of functionalism. He said if houses were really functionalist, they wouldn't look anything like houses we have today. And what the Bauhaus did was use geometry. In a way, of course, that was what De Stael group were using. But De Stael group didn't have modular matters. Well, they did. That was not quite true. Some of their houses were modular. Everybody did modular houses at some point in that period between the wars and even just after.
Because Behrens is influential.
I don't know what Behrens taught them, but he had this extraordinary team of young men.
And that's before the Bauhaus starts. So, yeah, Behrens is before.
Yes, that's right.
And does Behrens emphasize function?
I think the whole thing of Sachlichkeit, that was a word they used a lot. So, yes, I think they all struggled to decide really what they meant by a piece of architecture that was really, truly functional. But they never seemed, in the end, to come up with it. I mean, for instance, when Mies van der Rohe designed the Seagram building, that's, for the Canadian people who ran Seagram's Liquors, that huge building just below the Central Station in New York on Park Avenue.
Right.
There seems to be modular elements in that all the way, and it's certainly a very imposing like building. But whether it really fits with the idea of the functional is another matter. I don't know enough about it. But I do know, though, that in many of those high buildings, one whole concrete floor could be easily changed to be used by whatever agency wanted to buy into it.
Yeah.
So there is something functional about it. Whether the functionality has to do with which way it faces, how much sun comes in, how you modify the heating and lighting systems and all the rest, I don't know.
So you have De Stael. What about constructivism in Russia?
Constructivism comes like this. It's fairly simple to talk about. You have Malevich. Malevich is a theosophist. who's read the Russians and so on. Of course, he doesn't speak any language except Russian because he's not a tremendously educated guy. He just goes to art school and he learns to paint. But he becomes a symbolist. Then he gets involved with the sort of background of symbolism, which is theosophy. And his work begins to change. And there's a lot of competition in Moscow and St. Petersburg because the two cities are sort of constantly being raided by the artists. But they are very competitive. And on the occasion when one of them goes to Paris, sees Picasso, comes back, and makes works that remind you of Picasso's strange guitars made from cocoa tins and things. He comes back and does that, and Malevich seems now in second place when he thought he was in first place among the avant-garde. And he goes away, sort of shuts himself up for a year, and then he announces that he's going to have a one-person show, and he hangs this show, and people go in and they see the most extraordinary things. They see a black square hung in the corner of the exhibition room. Of course, it's not a very elegant exhibit. It's goodness knows where it was. You know, I mean, he couldn't afford much. So the place is full of his new works, two or three, one above the other and so on. But this one black square is across the corner of the room, and it's in the place where traditionally Russians put their family icon, the most religious item in the house. So you can read that it is a religious icon, but you can't see why. But you could see why if you could have followed his progress in the previous two or three years, because to him it's become increasingly obvious that, to him as a theosophist too, that somehow or other you've got to end the representation of figures and find a substitute. So he looks upon this black square as a sort of origin of the universe, as an egg that will explode and give you all around the room the different kinds of squares and oblongs and
rectangles.
Yes, I'm not quite sure how far it goes, but they're in, some of them in color, some are in black, some and so on. And everyone is in shock, but everything, lots of them are impressed. And he gets a following of some very bright young people, so that as he develops this work.
Now, this first black presentation, is that 1915 or so? Is that during World War One?
Yes, it is 1915. I think that's the year.
Exactly. Yes, before the revolution, too, the Russian Revolution. So.
Yes, and what's interesting is that these young students that follow him, because he's now in his middle to late 30s, they become very significant artists as the revolution in Russia takes place, because for a time, because these people are, if you like, revolutionary within the art scene, they are seen by the political revolutionaries as speaking for them, so to speak. So for 4 or 5 years at the most, after the revolution of late 1917 and 18, they are there and they're accepted. Their aesthetic ideas of rather mechanistic and geometric figures, very abstract, they're regarded by the politicos as just the stuff that is needed. The rest is bourgeois nonsense. But after they have established themselves, after they have created a theater for themselves, in Malevich's terms, they've even created some buildings. He made like three-dimensional models of some of these paintings, and regarded them as designs for habitation. They never were used, and they look as habitation, they look rather silly. But other people who actually were architects joined the same kind of way of looking at architecture that we've already mentioned in De Stael and in the Bauhaus. So you have a similar kind of architecture taking place. And then suddenly, Stalin says, this is nonsense. What we want is good figurative art to appeal to the population. And as that idea is taken up by the party, these people become more and more persecuted. In the end, Mondrian is almost afraid to make anything more.
You mean Malevich, not Mondrian, Malevich.
Oh, I'm sorry, Malevich, yes.
Thanks. Malevich. And do some of them get killed?
Mayakovsky, who was a poet and a playwright, shot himself in 1930. Mm. He did it out of absolute frustration and probably out of fear that he'd gone too far for Stalin.
Right.
And when Malevich actually managed to get some of his work out of Russia and into Berlin, probably around 1928, he told the museum director where it was shown to keep it. And that's why we have quite a good representation of Malevich's work, because it never went back to Russia. Had it gone back, there's no knowing what would come of it.
Right.
And when the war began, Second World War, this extraordinary museum director put all of the stuff away somewhere in the bottom basement of the building, and luckily it survived. So we do have quite a lot of his work.
Yeah, so you have him in Berlin, you have Peggy Guggenheim saving the Surrealists and getting them all over to New York. Do any of, you got Mies van der Rohe, do any of the Bauhaus guys end up in New York in the 40s influenced by the Surrealist Museum that Peggy Guggenheim started? Is there any mixture there?
They don't. And what's interesting is that she asked an architect to build her two sections, one for them and one for the Surrealists.
Oh.
So they were separated. It's interesting to see the photos of these two big rooms because they're hung in completely different ways.
That'll lead into the second point. That sounds like the poets and the painters' school.
Well, I hope we can pick up the pieces.
No, we will.
Finish this next time.
Okay. All right, so here's what's something that hadn't struck me before. What I've learned today is that you've got the Bauhaus artists and architects. You got De Stael artists and architects, and you got constructivism. Any other terms in Russia? Is it mainly just constructivism?
Yes, there is.
You don't
because,
have to go into it. Begins with S, right? Isn't there something called something begins with S? I'm trying to remember. Anyways, the point is that each school is influenced, Russia, the Dutch and the German is influenced by theosophy. That's pretty amazing.
It is pretty amazing, yes. I mean, it's certain in De Stael. It's there in the background of the Bauhaus. It's in Malevich for certain, although it evolves into something which is, what's the word in...
Social realism.
Not socialist realism, but that was what they feared and what drove them out of business.
You're saying that constructivism evolved into some other term?
Before they called it constructivism, they called it productivism.
Oh.
And that sounds good, for the politicos, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Productivity.
Exactly. What they do is like a reminder of how to get the factories working again or something.
Right. Now, the theosophical influence on these schools overlaps with n-dimensional influence on the architectural painter gang?
I think to some degree, yes. I think you could safely say that if you had asked Malevich why he was doing these four long oblongs and one blue oblong that crosses all of them, and asking him, is this two-dimensional, three-dimensional, or is it four-dimensional? I think he might have said, these are spiritual paintings. And so it's they're four-dimensional.
Right.
They're, you know, I think every time a theosophist speaks and makes a picture, they make a picture which has this element of the fourth spiritual dimension in it.
Not necessarily n-dimensional that the physicists...
No, of course not. I think that because Blavatsky says it.
Right.
Blavatsky says there is a fourth spiritual dimension. But what we said earlier was that was not just Blavatsky in the end. It was backed up by all the mathematicians of the 19th century who not only said, yes, she's right about four dimensions, we don't know about the spiritual nonsense, but we know about four dimensions because we know about 10 or a million dimensions, you know.
All right, so we'll end with that. That's half your thesis, the School of Architects and Painters. Next time we'll do the Poets and Painters, which is another thread in 20th century art, correct?
Yes, that's it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dennis.
Okay, my pleasure.